تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام، چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی،
human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
وقتی شخصیت امیرالمومنین رو بشناسه در مقابل او خضوع میکند.
In the name of Allah, assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiyya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life. Brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, I convey all this to you lest inordinate desires, temptations, and inducement should start influencing you, or adverse changes of times and circumstances should drag your name in the mire, or I should leave you like an untrained colt, because a young and fresh mind is like a virgin soil which allows things sown in it to grow verdantly and to bear luxuriantly. Then, I have made use of early opportunities to educate you and train you before your mind loses its freshness, before it gets hardened or warped, before you start facing life unprepared for the encounter, and before you are forced to use your decisions and discretions without gaining advantages of accumulated traditions, collected knowledge, and experiences of others. These words of advice and counsels that I give you will save you from the worry of acquiring knowledge, gathering experiences, and soliciting advice from others. Now, you can easily make use of all the knowledge which men have to acquire with great care, trouble, and patience. Things which were hidden from them and which only experiences and sufferings could bring to light are now made easily available to you through these exhortations. My dear son, though the span of my life is not as that of some other people who have passed away before me, yet I took great care to study their lives. Assiduously, I went through their activities. I contemplated over their deliberations and deeds. I studied their remains, relics, and ruins. I pondered over their lives so deeply that I felt as if I have lived and worked with them from early ages of history down to our times, and I know what did them good and what brought them harm.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
In the Islamic faith, the position of Ali as far as Imamat is concerned is so pivotal that without him, Islam will lose its right bearings. although I'm putting in these words, but these are actually the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen. In one of the early khutbas, which he issued after the Muslims accepted him as their Khalifa and their leader, he says, يَنَحَدِرُ عَنِّ السَّيْلِ وَلَا يَرْقَى عِلَيَّ الطَّيْرِ. He says, you know, the flood actually flows down from me, and the bird cannot fly up to my level. These are all poetic words he's talking about. He says, you know, basically describing himself as a very tall mountain, which has the source of water there, and the water is flowing down. He says, the benefit and the wisdom and the knowledge comes from me. It flows from me. In response to another statement where he has, in response to the letter that Muawiyah wrote to him, you know, Amir al-Mu'mineen comes to a point. It's a very interesting letter, but for some other time, inshallah. We have talked about it previously, where Ali says that, you know, I hesitate to do praise myself. So he goes into praising the Ahlul Bayt in general, and specifically Fatima, Hassan, Hussein, and Hamza, and Ja'far. But when it comes to himself, he says, you know, I'll just leave you with one word, one sentence. And he says, you know, for you it's enough to know, فَإِنَّ سَنَايَ رَبِّنَا وَالنَّاسُ بَعْدَ سَنَايَ عَلَنَا, that we are the direct recipients of the favors of our Lord, while others receive the favors from us, through us, from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so when he's talking about, you know, that I am the central point, the pivotal point, this is not only the issue of knowledge and wisdom and leadership, it is also when it comes to the blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so he says, I am that flood which is flowing from the top of the mountain. And by saying that, لا يرقى إلي الطير, you know, no bird cannot reach to me. Basically, he's saying that I am such a tall mountain that even the most powerful bird cannot reach me. They can try, but they will never be able to reach to my position and my status.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Joint statement by the diplomatic missions of the Western countries in Islamabad has created an uproar in Pakistan. The statement posted on the social media platforms presses Pakistan to condemn Russia. The statement was signed by the envoys of European countries and endorsed by the US Embassy in Islamabad.
The move by the Western diplomatic missions here has drawn strong reaction from the Pakistani government. The Foreign Office has summoned the envoys of the Western countries to tell them that issuing public statements against the host country is not in line with the diplomatic protocols.
On Sunday, Prime Minister Imran Khan doubled down on the European ambassadors and made it clear that Pakistan is not their slave.
I want to ask the European ambassadors, did you write such a letter to India? What do you think of us? are we your slaves, that whatever you say, we will do.
Pakistan has maintained a fine balance in the ongoing conflict between Russia and the West over Ukraine. The reason Pakistan refused to condemn Russia stems from its growing ties with Moscow.
The only thing that I can say from Pakistan's government perspective that Pakistan wants de-escalation. Honestly, Pakistan wants end of the war or end of bombing or end of aggression anywhere for that matter in the world.
Pakistan has remained in the Western camp for decades, but now wants to diversify its foreign policy options. It was because of this reason that despite pressure from the West, Pakistan abstained from the voting on a resolution against Russia at the UN General Assembly session. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Under the title, the detention of fuel ships is a U.S. decision and our choice is Yemen's hurricane operations, thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities to protest against the Saudi blockade imposed on the country.
The Yemeni people today came out to send a message to the world that they will not sit idle against this stifling siege backed by the U.S. and enforced under the supervision of the U.K. and members of the Saudi-led coalition. The siege is aimed to bring the Yemenis to their knees.
The protests are taking place amid the worst fuel crisis in Yemen since the beginning of the war, as Saudi Arabia keeps seizing Yemeni oil vessels despite obtaining entry permits by the UN. The long lines of people queuing at fuel stations in the capital Sana'a have reached 4 kilometers for the first time.
The Saudi-led coalition continues to seize Yemeni oil ships amid the silence of the United Nations. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council overlooks the violations of Saudi Arabia and its allies. We call on the international community to look at Yemen as it does with Ukraine and to stand by the millions of Yemenis who have been suffering for 7 years.
Recently, Saudi Arabia tightened the siege it imposes on Yemen and led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage. This has pushed the healthcare system to the verge of collapse, threatening the lives of millions of Yemenis, including children.
Protesters hold the U.S. responsible for supporting the Saudi detention of oil ships, saying Washington is a major partner in the war against their country. They believe that the Yemeni army operations against Emirati and Saudi territories, especially those against Aramco facilities, are the only way to lift the siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In a historic and surprising decision, the European Union has decided to give refugees from war the instant right to live within the bloc and freely travel. They also have the right to work. They even now have rights to housing and medical care. There is one catch. This only applies to Ukrainians. These rights are not being extended to refugees from Palestine, Yemen, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, Mali, the Central African Republic, or any of the other countries in which Western armed interventions provoked refugee crises. Seemingly no one would begrudge Ukrainian refugees their human rights, but many in France are wondering why they are getting treated totally differently from black, brown, and Muslim asylum seekers.
Apparently, you have to be white and Christian to be treated properly by the European Union. That's the sad reality, and it's totally unacceptable. We cannot discriminate according to religion, nationality, or color, which are all things which we don't choose. What we can choose is to be human and to have solidarity with each other.
Drowning by the dozens in Calais, France. Freezing to death in Poland. Packed into camps in Italy, building steel fences, denying basic sanitation, fear-mongering about refugees election after election. The long-running European refugee crisis has taken a new turn, and yet standard European policy remains mostly unchanged. An outcry is growing for the European Union to extend their unity, and many say their humanity, towards non-white refugees.
We have to receive refugees and give them normal, humane conditions, regardless of what continent they come from. We have seen acts towards refugees on the Polish border, and we can't allow such things to happen in France. The government has to treat all refugees with total equality and with urgent measures like proper lodging.
Many say the open discrimination, which reveals a deep racism and xenophobia, as well as an arrogant hypocrisy, will ultimately stain the European Union around the world and at home. Many in the French media are describing Ukrainian refugees as somehow qualitatively superior to other asylum seekers. However, many hope that the European Union realizes soon that all refugees are equal and deserving of dignity, assistance, and the same rights without discrimination. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
When it comes to NATO support and American leadership, we have better ask Afghans. They have the experience of 20 years of Western forces presence in their country. Afghans had counted on Western powers at the beginning, but what the US and its allies really brought for Afghanistan?
Betrayal, definitely. The US and its allies' presence led our country to gallop backward. However, they failed in Afghanistan and ruined our country. We didn't gain anything from dealing with the West except destruction, poverty, and many, many crises.
Sayed Bakir Kazemi was an advisor to the former Afghan president Ashraf Ghani. He believes Ghani's government easily collapsed because he trusted the US and relied on NATO forces.
It is obvious and historically proven that any government or administration that trusted the US or relied on the West ended up with failure and downfall. This experience is repeated in many countries. Former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani did the same mistake and faced a bad downfall.
Some Afghan experts also blame crisis in Ukraine on the US, saying nations are falling victim to the US policies of creating war and terror.
The US is using Ukrainians for its own benefits. Western powers don't care about the collapse and destruction of a nation or government. They follow their own devil policies. Afghanistan's experience is repeating in Ukraine. I hope Ukrainians' leaders learn from Afghanistan's disaster and crisis ends in their country.
After 20 years of invasion, the US and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year. Today, the country is dealing with the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Afghans are critical of US policies and its legacy on their soil. They consider trusting the US as a big mistake that no country should ever make it. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
British Muslims massed outside Pakistan's High Commission in London, condemning sectarian killings of the country's Shia minority. The vigil comes after a suicide bomber struck inside a Shia Muslim mosque in the northwestern city of Peshawar during Friday prayers last week, killing around 60 worshippers and wounding some 196 people.
The attack may have taken place thousands of miles away, but the pain and hurt that has been felt has resonated across the Muslim world. As you can see behind me, well over 100 people have turned out here today to not only send their thoughts and prayers back to Pakistan, but also to vent their anger and fury at the fact that these types of attacks are still taking place even now.
Daesh claimed responsibility for the attack. The terror group has threatened more violence against Pakistan's Shia. But these worshippers issued strong words of their own.
Shias are like a seed. You bury one and it sprouts out a million more. And they can continue to do whatever they're doing. And I look into their eyes right now and I say, you continue to do what you're doing, but you will never succeed in ending the Shia of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
We shouldn't have to live in fear that if we go to pray on a Friday, we won't come back. We should know that we're safe and that we're able to do all of this freely. And I want everybody to understand this, that we're taking action because This has happened several times and this needs to stop.
If becoming a creature like you is called being a Muslim, then I think I'm fine with the religion that I stand with, and I think I'm fine. All of these people that are here also stand with me.
Friday's attack was the deadliest in the country since 2018, when 149 people lost their lives, including 9 children, in a terrorist explosion at an election rally in Balochistan. With more than one sectarian terrorist group active in Pakistan, many fear these bloodthirsty bombings will continue to plague Pakistan's religious minorities. Robert Carter, London.
Waiting until the final moment to register in order to skirt laws on equal media time for election candidates, French President Emmanuel Macron confirmed he will run for re-election. The slate of candidates is now finalized. Macron began his term hailed as the new leader of the free world, but his once-in-a-century repression of the Yellow Vests has many calling him a liberal strongman who enforces rubber bullet liberalism. Macron is leading in the first round and has a comfortable lead in the second round of roughly 60 to 40 over far-right mainstay Marine Le Pen. The Russian special military operation in Ukraine has given Macron a 5-point increase in the past 2 weeks, and the ending of extremely strict coronavirus rules in mid-March may lead to another increase. However, Western polling agencies have become severely discredited in recent years, with France's largest newspaper refusing to run any of them.
I don't believe the polls, which are all conducted by private companies who deliver the results, which they are paid to deliver. Macron's track record is catastrophic. He's achieved nothing for the average person. It's truly the dictatorship of a total capitalist. France has really reached the bottom.
The campaign hasn't been centered around the incumbent's record, but openly Islamophobic ideas. Despite running third or fourth in the polls, far-right convicted racist Eric Zemmour has been allowed by media executives to set the agenda.
The rise of the extreme right is totally unsupportable, and we have no choice but to confront these ideas of fascism, racism, and xenophobia. France must stand up as one and say no. I'm sure that France will, and I'm sure no far-right candidate will reach the second round.
The resulting lack of serious issues appears certain to produce record abstention. Just 52% of France is interested in the vote this year, compared to 78% for the previous election. 3 weeks ago, all of the leading candidates were openly pro-Russian, but France's media has been swept by a wave of war hysteria, which usually benefits the incumbent. However, for many, at least that has pushed Islamophobia off the agenda, at least for now. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
On Saturday, over 30,000 people staged a rally in the Italian capital against the escalating war between Russia and Ukraine. The initiative was called by trade unions, leftist groups and pro-peace movements as fighting rages on in a number of Ukrainian cities and talks between Kyiv and Moscow have produced very little so far. The protesters chanted slogans for peace and the end of all wars, urging the United Nations to do more to mediate between Russia, Ukraine and all parties related to the ongoing Ukrainian crisis.
Rather than investing in social welfare, labor, health and education systems, in Western countries have been wasting resources on armaments. Today, Russia must be held accountable for the Ukraine crisis.
Anti-war rallies have been held across Italy over the past days. Most of the demonstrations held in Rome, Palermo, Milan and other Italian cities have been in solidarity with Ukraine.
People at the rally have mixed feelings over who should be held accountable for the war in Ukraine. The majority believe there is a shared responsibility upon all the parts involved, from the US and the NATO to Russia's President Vladimir Putin.
In Italy, the most recent government update places the number of Ukrainian refugees who have entered the country since the start of the war at about 9,000. According to Ukrainian-Italian associations, up to 800,000-900,000 refugees may reach Italy in the coming weeks. Max Civili, Rome.
Head of the UN Atomic Watchdog, Rafael Grossi, was once again in Tehran in less than 3 months to resolve what he called important obstacles in the way of concluding the Vienna talks, which are ongoing between Iran and the P4+1, with the aim of reviving the 2015 deal. In a joint presser, Grossi and head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, said they agree on a roadmap to resolve all the IAEA questions about Iran's nuclear program by late June.
It's a real pleasure to be back in Iran, in Tehran, and with President Islami, with whom we had a very fruitful and intense exchange this morning.
We have agreed to provide the IAEA by June 21st with documents related to outstanding questions between Tehran and the agency.
The IAEA has been seeking answers from Iran on traces of uranium it has allegedly found in old Iranian nuclear facilities. Falling in the category of the safeguards issues, this topic seems to be a major sticking point, blocking an agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks. And as Grossi described, it's intertwined with the fate of the discussions in Vienna.
They are very closely interrelated, and it would be difficult to believe or to imagine that such an important return to such a comprehensive agreement like Barjam would be possible if the agency and Iran would not be seeing eye to eye on how to resolve these important safeguards issues.
Iran has vehemently dismissed the IAEA's safeguards narrative as a political claim, calling on the nuclear watchdog to stick to its technical task and avoid being influenced by, quote, political lobbying.
I urge Mr. Grossi that political influence and lobbying should not impact the decisions of the IAEA. Iran and the IAEA should follow their issues in a completely professional way and behave within the framework of expertise.
Grossi's visit to Tehran is seen as a major push to sort out the last differences in the Austrian capital, which has hosted numerous rounds of talks to remedy the crippled 2015 deal. In 2018, then-U.S. President Donald Trump pulled Washington out of the accord and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Tehran, in return, scaled back its compliance with part of the agreement.
Both Grossi and the Iranian atomic chief agreed that their meeting was fruitful. This could mean that another roadblock has been removed, and negotiators in Vienna will only have to cross the T's before a final conclusion is reached. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
EU foreign affairs ministers held yet another emergency meeting on Friday evening in Brussels to take stock of many Ukraine-related issues. The flow of refugees into EU nations was discussed at length. The impact of recently announced Western sanctions on Russia was assessed.
We are not under regime change. The sanctions are not in order to provoke a regime change in Russia.
Borrell says the sanctions are in fact designed to end the deadly conflict. NATO foreign ministers also met on Friday and reaffirmed their stance of not being drawn into the war. They acknowledged the results could be catastrophic. However, NATO allies continue to send thousands of additional troops into eastern parts of the 30-nation alliance.
And we have over 130 jets at high alert and over 200 ships from the high north to the Mediterranean.
Experts say the US is controlling all of the West's next moves, and the decision to supply deadly arms to Ukraine was a mistake.
The Europeans are saying to the Ukrainian, we're not going to send men to fight with you, we're not going to fight by your side, we give you weapons for you to fight. And had that not happened, President Zelensky would have talked to Russia from day one and avoided this war.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken attended all of the key events in Brussels on Friday, focusing on Ukraine.
Unfortunately, tragically, horrifically, this may not be over soon. And so these efforts that we're making together, we have to sustain them.
A number of political commentators are saying this crisis could have been averted if Russia's legitimate security concerns had been listened to. Therefore, they suggest the onus is now on Western leaders to bring about de-escalation as a matter of urgency. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
An important new Atlantic peace on the trauma of the withdrawal should be put in the wider context of American incompetence, says Adam Weinstein, writer, in an article published under the heading, "The Tragic U.S. Exit from Afghanistan was rooted in decades of failure." Stay tuned for more. The betrayal of Afghanistan was solidified years ago when U.S. leaders made promises they should have or must have known they could never keep. The inevitable consequences of creating a hollow government, bloated public sector, and an aid-dependent war economy hung over Afghanistan like a suspended prison sentence. The recent memory of botched evacuation is naturally the most salient example of the U.S. failure in Afghanistan. Journalist George Packer's important profile recently in The Atlantic of the final month of the U.S. evacuation in Afghanistan revealed how the value of an Afghan life came down to their proximity to the right American, individual ruthlessness, and blind luck. But the overwhelming scale of humanitarian trauma at Kabul's airport, as laid out in The Atlantic, might inadvertently lead readers to believe this was an aberration. It wasn't. Over two decades, the fate of individuals and entire villages hinged on their shifting positions relative to the insurgency and U.S.-led so-called counterinsurgency. It is difficult for veterans, diplomats, journalists, aid workers, and many others who dedicated portions of their lives to transform Afghanistan to grapple with a takeover. It may even be more difficult for Washington as an institution to accept. The complacency leading up to the horrific attacks of 9/11 became Washington's original sin, and the so-called War on Terror was its salvation with the invasion of Afghanistan at its opening salvo. The 9/11 attacks on Afghanistan remained a central part of the legal framework and popular understanding of an increasingly entropic so-called war on terror. Perhaps this was why the sheer scale of the U.S. failure in Afghanistan is so difficult for some to accept. The initial invasion freed Afghanistan from repressive grips and temporarily scattered terrorists who had found refuge there, but it also produced unsavory partnerships, mass graves, and a rebirth of world lordism, and serves as a testament to man's ingenuity in the pursuit of torture and cruelty, particularly at Guantanamo Bay. The so-called War on Terror stumbled along in a wayward stupor into Baghdad, and by the time President Obama took office, the insurgency was gaining too much momentum to be ignored. The surge that followed created a web of forward operating bases and combat outposts that protected provincial capitals and Kabul. For some Afghans, this was an era of exponential growth, optimism, and hope for the future. But this progress was underpinned by a violent so-called counterinsurgency that didn't just create orphans and widows, but also the illusion of coalition control over large swathes of Afghanistan, and when in reality, the Taliban often operated freely just several hundred meters away. It is easy for Americans to delude themselves into believing that violence was the currency of their proponents alone, when in reality it was the common denominator. The Taliban were removed by force, the Afghan government was kept in power by force, and the Taliban returned to power by force. Does the world have anything else to offer Afghanistan? Afghanistan's winners and losers rotated, but the violence grew with each year. Today, Washington's slow strangulation of Afghanistan's economy is shrugged off as the inevitable consequence of the decision to negotiate in bad faith, take the country back by force, and elevate their most objectionable figures. We deny this responsibility for the crisis that has plunged Afghanistan into rubbles. Sound familiar? But the disaster unfolding before Americans' eyes is not predestined. It is American-made. Another common threat of the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan is a discourse that elevated talking points over uncomfortable truths until the latter became so glaringly obvious that to ignore them would be unhinged. It was no secret that Ashraf Ghani was an incompetent leader who surrounded himself with corrupt, sycophantic yes-men and ignored any advice and ran counter to his political aims. Not until the Afghan government collapsed like a house of cards did it become entirely acceptable to be so blunt about the extent of the rot. A voluminous public record of shoddy targeting and U.S. strikes gone awry existed well before last August, but it took a strike on 10 innocent people, including an aid worker and 7 children, to finally receive appropriate attention. These are but two examples of narrative that said one thing publicly, another in hushed tones. Why then does the evacuation captivate many people in particular? For one, that mission is not over. Afghan partners continue to be rescued through the tireless work of volunteers. It absolutely must continue and is intrinsically more valuable than any reflection rooted in cynicism. But the evacuation is one chapter in a story that should humble Americans as a country. America sought to transform Afghanistan, but in the end, it could not even manage its own special immigrant visa program. Burdened by unimaginative bureaucracy, lack of leadership, and the darkest side of domestic politics, America left tens of thousands of Afghan partners to languish. Even minimal creativity and desire could have saved so many of those who supported the U.S. over two decades. Dozens of major decision points and thousands of smaller ones throughout the U.S. war in Afghanistan could have been decided differently. To remove that agency from Americans as a nation would be disingenuous, but to dwell on it, it is also to miss the big picture. As Packer wrote so eloquently, something of value always fragile and dependent on foreigners had been accomplished. This was the fait accompli of the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, which built something that could not be sustained without Americans. Afghanistan was never a priority, and it never could be, because Americans are not Afghans.
Maybe this center, Majma' al-Dhakhar al-Islamiyya, is a personal institution that Sayyid Ahmad Hosseini Eshkevari established in 1355 when he was at his middle ages.
So he was really believing in this concept that I am trying to provide this generation with the key to the treasure. Treasure of their heritage and legacy back to Islam, to know Islam much better.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher. What will we say in front of it?
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, to discuss the life and works of another Muslim Shia dignitary, are two guest speakers from the Islamic Hausa of Qom, Sheikh Mahdawi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Mahdawi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today we want to talk about an outstanding Shiite bibliographer, you know, a codicologist, and also an expert on Islamic manuscript, Islamic texts, who dedicated his life in order to study and do research about the manuscripts and Islamic texts in different lands and different libraries. He is no one but Sayyid Ahmad Hosseini Eshkevari. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you, brother. What information do we have about the early life and the biography of Sayyid Ahmad Hosseini Eshkevari?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Ahmad Asif Hosseini Eshkevari was born in 13 of Rabiul Awwal in 1350, according to lunar calendar, in Najaf al-Ashraf. And it's in 1310 in solar calendar.
Yes.
Because his grandfather moved from the province of Gilan in Iran, in north of Iran, to Najaf to study in Islamic studies. This family was, living in Najaf. And his father was also born in Najaf, and he himself, I mean Sayyid Ahmad, also was born in Najaf. And their generation goes back, or their roots goes back to Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam, the fifth Imam of Shia school of thought.
That's right.
He started his Islamic studies in Najaf al-Ashraf, and because he faced with some, economic problems, he moved to Baghdad to work besides studying. This is very important. Because some people would say that working is not allowed for some, you know, scholars. But he was not believing in this.
Okay.
And he tried to work besides studying to handle the expenses of his life. And after 4 years that he achieved some, you know, properties and he could handle his social and economical expenses, he moved again to Najaf, studied for 9 years there.
That's right.
And because of the problems that the Ba'ath regime party was putting on scholars, he had no way but to leave Najaf, and
yes,
he came to Iran and to the city of Qom.
That's right.
In Qom, he was teaching for almost 2 years. And after that, he left teaching and he started the maybe second phase of his life that is very important, and that is being a researcher regarding the manuscripts and books and to trying to write the indexes regarding the manuscripts in different libraries.
That's right.
Of course, before going to this step and to this phase of his life, we should mention that Sayyid Ahmad Asif Eshkevari was benefited from very well-known scholars like Marhum Agha Bozorg Tehrani,
yes,
and also Sheikh Muhammad Taghi Shushtari, that these two great figures gave him the permission of Rivayat.
That's right.
And also he was a student of late Sayyid Khoui Rahmatullah Alayh. And also he got benefited from Mirza Hashem Amali Rahmatullah Alayh, Mirza Hassan Bujnordi,
okay,
and late Allama Tabatabai, according,
yes,
Islamic mysticism and Islamic,
right,
philosophy. But the most important point and most important part of his life is that he was a codicologist and,
yes,
bibliographer. So he traveled,
yes,
to more than 29 countries to collect the books of Islamic different fields.
That's right.
To, you know, promote the Islamic studies.
Okay, that's all right.
His best.
What is the need at all, Sheikh Mahdavi, to this kind of approach? I mean, going to different libraries and providing indexes or bibliographies for them. What is the benefit of this action?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think if you ask this question from Sayyid Ahmad Husseini Eshkevari, he will give you a very nice response. He has said that what I am doing, that he calls that composing the table of content for the libraries.
Okay.
He says, what I am doing is a key to the treasure.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it mean? It means as long as you don't have the key, you cannot get any access to the treasure. You can't get any of that. You might be living beside the treasure, but as long as you don't have the key with you, you can benefit from it. So he is giving the importance of what he is doing through this job. And as we look at his works, we see that he is really true.
That's right.
So among the works that he has authored and conduct, more than 62 books have been conducted, among which it's sometimes you go to the library of Ayatollah Marashi Najafi,
yes,
and you start composing table of content and enumerating all manuscripts which are there,
yes,
but sometimes you go to Yemen.
No.
This is, yes. So he has conducted 3 volumes in all Shia or Zaydi works which are available as the manuscripts,
yes,
in the libraries of Yemen.
Yes.
As the same as what my brother mentioned, it was not only to such Muslim countries,
yes,
to go to other countries.
Okay.
So he was really believing in this concept,
that's right,
that I am trying to provide this generation with the key to the treasure
right,
of their heritage and,
okay,
legacy,
yes,
back to Islam, to know Islam much better.
Right.
So we see the benefit,
mm-hmm,
of the information.
That's right.
If we do not have much information about ourselves, for example, like the example that I raised regarding the Yemeni or Zaydis,
mm-hmm,
which are considered one of the sub-branches of Shiism,
yes,
we don't have much information about them. Rather, having information about the books that they have,
yes,
in their libraries. But we have to be really grateful to the jobs that this great man has offered and contributed for us.
Also about Iran and the public libraries in Iran, because Iran is believed to be a Shiite land, so many people in the Arab world or in the Islamic world, the world of Islam, want to be familiar with the writings or at least the list of the books and compilations that are available, isn't it, about the Shia Islam in the public libraries. That's why I think this book was compiled, isn't it? Yeah. At-Turas al-Arabi, yes. Al-Makhtud fi Maktabat al-Iran al-Amma.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. I was, as I said, more than 62 mm-hmm. books have been conducted in the same field of study. Okay. I just wanted to mention one of the rare topic to go to the Yemen, yes, and start making or composing research, table of, yes, content on whatever they have, mm-hmm, in their libraries, yes, and put it in three volumes. This, okay, is kind of unique job, mm-hmm, and very tough. That's right. At the same time.
Very difficult to do because, you know, just traveling to the other lands and making a list or index out of their books is a really difficult task. Also, he established two centers, Sheikh Ziyaniyah, or it's better to say two institutes and foundations regarding the Islamic studies on the texts and manuscripts. What are they?
Yes, he established two different centers regarding the revising the books, Islamic books. The first one is Islamic Heritage Revival Center, Merkez Ihya Mirath Islami. That this one is sponsored by the Office of Ayatollah Sistani, Hafadahullah. This center was established in 1374, mm-hmm, and the center is located in the city of Qom.
That's right.
And the activities of this center are in two different major fields. First of all is to find the books and, mm-hmm, to find manuscripts. And the second is to correcting these books and publishing them. So these, mm-hmm, two phases are the main activities of this center. Of course, there are some goals for this center. First of all is to, you know, let people know about these books and then to publish these books and also to bring up a database for the researcher so that can be easily have access to the books or the index of the books that they are in need and to find the books easily in different libraries. So this center is very important, and they have different parts like the picture division that is...
You mean providing photos?
Yes.
And the, that's right. And the pictures out of the manuscripts.
Yeah, okay. So they are providing microfilms regarding the, okay, books. Okay. So if a researcher tries wants to find, you know, manuscripts, they provide it for him to find the digital copies of the books.
That's right.
And they also have manuscripts, mm-hmm, and also they have some books that these books we call Hajari publications, you know, the old publications.
Lithography.
That, maybe.
Yes. Based on the lithography and the old ones, okay.
And beside all these, they have also a part, a division regarding the historical documents, mm-hmm, that they are collecting historical documents regarding the Qajari era.
Merkez Ihya Miras al-Islami, isn't,
yes,
it?
Yes. And beside this, he has established another center, Majma' al-Dakhair al-Islamiyya, that this center also is a research institution. Of course, this one is older than the first, mm-hmm, but maybe the extent of his activities is not as much as the first one. Mm-hmm. But they are trying also to collect the books and to publish the books. And maybe this center, Majma' al-Dakhair al-Islamiyya, is, mm-hmm, a personal institution that... Okay. Sayyid Ahmad Hosseini Eshkevari, you know, established in 1355 in, okay, solar calendar.
That's right.
Something like 45 years ago,
okay,
when he was, you know, at his middle ages.
That's right.
And nowadays, these centers are, you know, managed by his sons, mm-hmm, and they are trying,
that's
to,
right,
handle the situation because...
Okay. Really Sayyid great
Ahmad,
works.
Yes,
right.
Sayyid Ahmad Hosseini Eshkevari. Now, alhamdulillah, he's, yes, alive, but, yes, he is old and he cannot, yes, handle the situation all alone.
Really great works because, you know, in the past, so many of the outstanding and prominent works, manuscripts were handwritten, you know, and sometimes in the wars and in the attacks, they were burnt or they were destroyed. But nowadays, by the efforts of people like Sayyid Ahmad Husseini Ishkavari and the other codicologists and historiographers and bibliographers, they are kept as the legacy for the present and the future generation of the Muslims and also those who are interested in the research on the books and the codicology. Okay, anything missed, Sheikh Mahtavi, about Sayyid Ahmad Husseini Ishkavari?
I think his personality must be studied, and yes, we can take him as a role model.
Yes.
Why I am saying this? Because when it comes to a person who is in the society, we see how he is benefiting with the sense of humor, being generous. Now he has opened the doors of his private library, which is including above 26,000 mm-hmm. books to the people, to the researchers who come. So it shows that how he is generous and his perseverance.
Yes.
As he is saying, from his childhood till now, he was enjoying being with the books, reading and reading and reading, and being brave in terms of tackling huge jobs. He saying that as one of the interesting memory, when I was offered as my first work to go and make index on the books of the library of Ayatollah Mar'ashi Najafi, I was told by other people and different friends that that is a huge work, you cannot handle it. Mm-hmm. And I said, I have to do it. And I did it.
That's right.
And he reached the point and the position that he was not only permitted or received this permission from the scholars of Iran, in Yemen, in other countries.
Yes.
He got permission of narrating the riwayat or talking about the books and things like this. We have a nice, I think it's good to end my words with the nice word of late Ayatollah Hakimi. He is saying that we have two kinds of people among the scholars.
You mean Muhammad Reza Hakimi?
Muhammad Reza Hakimi.
Okay.
So he is saying that we have two kinds of scholars. One are those who are farhang sazan, those who are creating the culture. Mm-hmm. And the second group are farhang ban, meaning those who are protecting this culture.
The protector of the culture or legacy, is that right?
The legacy. Okay. So we have this legacy, but somebody has to protect it.
Oh,
if not, it will be ignored. It will fade away. So all efforts that they put forth will be vanished. So that is a nice point.
So Sayyid Ahmad Husseini Ishkavari is among the protectors
He is among farhang banan, means those who are protecting the legacy, and he did it.
May Allah protect him, and may he live long. Sayyid Ahmad Husseini Ishkavari, you know, the outstanding Muslim Shiite bibliographer, historiographer, and also an expert on codicology and Islamic manuscripts, whose efforts really are invaluable, really great works in the world of Islam and for Islamic libraries all across the world. Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyainia, for your presence in the program, The Teacher, talking about Sayyid Ahmad Husseini Ishkavari. And dear listeners, if you are interested in the life accounts of other Islamic scholars and Muslim scholars, you can visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.